A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. He's asking about cuddling. Why do we even do it? What's actually happening in the brain when we hug? And why does it get so complicated for new parents? And honestly, the timing is right. There's a new meta-analysis that just hit Neuroscience and Biobehavioral Reviews, preprint from May, showing that regular parental cuddling in the first 12 weeks cuts infant crying by 43% on average. But here's the number that actually made me stop. 68% of new parents in the same dataset reported feeling guilty about not wanting to cuddle more. So you've got this behavior that's almost absurdly effective, and the people who are supposed to do it feel terrible about not doing it enough. That's a tension worth understanding.
It really is. And the tension is the thing, because the popular narrative around cuddling is basically hugs are magic, oxytocin is the love drug, do more of it. And that's not wrong exactly, but it's so incomplete that it becomes misleading. Especially for new parents. You've got a mother at 3 weeks postpartum who flinches when her partner touches her shoulder because she's been cluster feeding for 4 hours and her nervous system is screaming, no more input. And she reads that she's supposed to be bathing her baby in loving touch or she'll damage the attachment bond. The guilt spiral from that mismatch is brutal, and it's built on bad science communication.
It reminds me of what happened with the 10,000 steps thing. Remember that? It was never a scientific target. It was a marketing number from a Japanese pedometer company in the 1960s. But it got repeated so many times that it calcified into medical advice, and now people feel like failures if they only hit 8,000. The cuddling narrative has the same shape, a kernel of real biology that got flattened into a moral imperative.
That's exactly the pattern. And the flattening is the problem, because it erases all the nuance that actually determines whether touch is helpful or harmful in a given moment.
The musical equivalent of beige wallpaper. It's pleasant enough that nobody questions it, but it flattens out all the texture that actually matters.
So let's back up and ask the deceptively simple question, why do we even do this? What's actually happening in the brain and body when we wrap our arms around someone?
I think the place to start is we didn't invent this, we inherited it.
Hugging in humans is the evolutionary descendant of primate allogrooming. If you watch chimpanzees or bonobos, they spend hours picking through each other's fur. It's not just hygiene, it's the primary social bonding mechanism. Robin Dunbar's work showed that allogrooming releases beta endorphins, lowers heart rate, reduces stress markers. It's the glue that holds primate social groups together.
Dunbar being the same guy who gave us Dunbar's number, the cognitive limit on stable social relationships.
And his argument, which I think holds up really well, is that as hominins lost body fur and group sizes expanded, manual grooming stopped being practical. You can't groom 200 group members one at a time, so we needed a more efficient bonding mechanism, and hugging, along with vocal communication and laughter, filled that gap. A hug gives you a lot of the same neurochemical payoff as 5 minutes of grooming, compressed into seconds.
Which explains why a good hug feels like it does something. You're not imagining it. It's literally triggering a pathway that evolved for social cohesion.
The hardware that does the triggering is where it gets really interesting, because this is the part most popular coverage gets wrong. There's a specific class of nerve fibers called C-tactile afferents. These are unmyelinated, meaning they're slow conducting, and they exist solely in hairy skin. They don't respond to fast touch, they don't respond to pressure, they don't respond to vibration. They fire specifically and only to slow, gentle stroking, between 1 and 10 centimeters per second, with peak response at about 3 centimeters per second.
3 centimeters per second? That is, I'm trying to visualize, that's a very deliberate stroke. Not a pat, not a rub.
It's almost absurdly slow. Loken and colleagues first characterized this in 2009, and it's been replicated with fMRI multiple times since, most recently, in 2023. When you stroke skin at exactly that speed, the C-tactile afferents fire and projub directly to the posterior insular cortex, which is the part of the brain that processes interoceptive awareness, your sense of your own body state. And from there, it projects to regions involved in social processing and emotional regulation. It's not a pain pathway. It's not a temperature pathway. It's a dedicated safe touch. Channel.
We literally have a nerve type whose entire job is someone you trust is here. Slow down.
That's the most parsimonious interpretation. The C-tactile system seems to code for affiliative touch, the kind of touch that says, you're in your in-group, you're safe. And when those fibers fire, you get a cascade, oxytocin release from the paraventricular nucleus of the hypothalamus, which binds to receptors in the amygdala and dampens fear responses. Simultaneously, it hits the nucleus accumbens, the reward center, so the touch feels not just calming, but positively good.
This is where the oxytocin equals love hormone story came from, right?
Yes, and this is also where the story starts to break, because oxytocin is not a simple feel-good molecule. It's context-sensitive in ways that are genuinely counterintuitive. There was a 2024 study in psychoneuroendocrinology that gave participants intranasal oxytocin and then measured their startle response. In people with low baseline cortisol, so relatively unstressed, oxytocin reduced the startle response, exactly as you'd expect. But in people with high baseline cortisol, oxytocin actually increased their startle. It made them more reactive to threat.
The same molecule can either calm you down or amp you up, depending on whether you're already stressed.
And this is the first major misconception to bust. The idea that cuddling always releases oxytocin and oxytocin always feels good. If you're in a high stress state, and new parents often are, the neurochemistry of touch can flip. The same slow stroke that would feel wonderful on a relaxed Sunday morning can feel invasive, irritating, even anxiety-producing when you're sleep-deprived and overstimulated.
How does that actually work at the receptor level? Because I think people hear oxytocin and imagine it's like a light switch. Either it's on and you feel good, or it's off and you don't. But you're describing something more like a modulator that amplifies whatever state you're already in.
That's exactly the right way to think about it. Oxytocin is a neuromodulator, not a neurotransmitter in the simple sense. It doesn't directly excite or inhibit. It changes the gain on existing circuits. So if your amygdala is already quiet, oxytocin quiets it further. But if your amygdala is already firing at high rates because your stress systems are activated, oxytocin can actually enhance that firing. It's turning up the volume on whatever channel is already playing.
Which makes intuitive sense if you think about it evolutionarily. If you're in a dangerous situation, you don't want a molecule that just sedates you. You want one that sharpens your assessment of whether this person touching you is actually safe.
And that's probably why the system evolved this way. Oxytocin isn't a trust drug, it's a salience drug. It makes social cues more prominent, whether those cues are positive or negative. In a safe context, that feels like bonding. In an unsafe or ambiguous context, it can feel like hypervigilance.
Which brings us to the touched out phenomenon.
Let's define it properly, because it's not just, I'm tired of being touched. Touched out is a specific form of tactile aversion that emerges from sensory overload. The mechanism involves the insular cortex, the same region that receives C-tactile input. When you're chronically overstimulated by touch, the insula becomes hyper-responsive. Light touch that would normally be coded as pleasant gets recoded as unpleasant. The valence flips.
Sleep deprivation lowers the threshold for this flip.
Sleep deprivation reduces the brain's capacity for sensory gating, the ability to filter out irrelevant stimuli, so every touch becomes more salient, more intrusive. For a new parent who's been holding a baby for hours, whose shirt is damp with milk or spit up, whose hair has been pulled, whose body has been climbed on, the nervous system just hits a ceiling. It's not a psychological failure. It's a predictable neurobiological response to sustained sensory input with inadequate recovery time.
The numbers on this are striking. That 2024 survey in the Journal of Perinatal Education found that about 62% of new mothers and 38% of new fathers report experiencing touched-out symptoms.
Those numbers are probably underestimates because there's a lot of shame around admitting it. The cultural messaging is relentless. Good mothers are physically available to their babies at all times. If you need to put the baby down, if you need your body to yourself, something is wrong with your maternal instinct. It's a devastating message, and it's completely unsupported by the neuroscience.
This is the second big misconception, right? That if you don't want to cuddle your baby, there's something wrong with your bonding.
Tactile aversion in new parents is not a failure of attachment. It's your nervous system doing exactly what a nervous system does under sustained load. It's protecting itself. The tragedy is that parents interpret this protective response as evidence that they're broken, and then they force themselves to provide touch that's tense, resentful, or dissociated, which the baby's nervous system can absolutely detect.
Let's talk about that. What's happening on the baby's side? Because if the parent is providing touch from a place of stress, does the baby actually register that difference?
The evidence suggests yes, and through multiple channels. Babies are exquisitely sensitive to the autonomic state of the person holding them. Heart rate, respiration rate, muscle tension, even skin temperature. All of these shift when someone is stressed versus regulated. A baby being held by a parent who's white-knuckling through sensory overload is getting a very different physiological signal than a baby being held by a parent who's calm and present. And the infant's own nervous system entrains to the caregiver's state. It's not just about the touch itself. It's about the entire autonomic context the touch is embedded in.
Forcing yourself to cuddle when you're overwhelmed might actually be counterproductive for the baby too.
And that's a really uncomfortable thing to say because it sounds like I'm telling stressed parents they're harming their babies. I'm not. What I'm saying is that the quality of the interaction matters more than the quantity, and that taking a brief reset before initiating contact can change the entire neurobiological transaction. That's not failure. That's skillful caregiving.
The infant's capacity to use touch for regulation develops along a specific timeline that aligns with the myelination of the vagus nerve. Polyvagal theory, and I know there's debate about some of Porges' claims, but the core observation holds. The vagus nerve is the main parasympathetic pathway, the brake on the stress response. In newborns, the vagal pathways are not fully myelinated, so the brake is unreliable. Between weeks 6 and 12 postpartum, myelination accelerates rapidly. This is exactly the period when skin-to-skin contact has been shown to have its most dramatic effects.
A 2024 randomized controlled trial in the Journal of Pediatrics showed that regular skin-to-skin during this period reduced colic symptoms by 50%.
What's actually happening physiologically when you put a baby skin-to-skin on a parent's chest? Because there's the thermal piece, there's the vagal piece. Walk me through the full picture.
The mechanism is probably bidirectional. Skin-to-skin contact stimulates the baby's C-tactile afferents. Yes, babies have them too, which activates the vagal brake and lowers heart rate. Simultaneously, the parent's chest provides thermal regulation that's actually more stable than an incubator. The parent's body temperature adjusts dynamically to the baby's needs. If the baby is too warm, the parent's chest vasodilates to dissipate heat. If the baby is too cool, vasoconstriction conserves it. No machine does this as responsively. And then there's the auditory component. The baby hears the parent's heartbeat, which is a familiar rhythm from the intrauterine environment. You're essentially recreating the sensory conditions the baby's nervous system evolved to expect, right at the moment when the vagal system is coming online.
Which is why kangaroo care works.
Kangaroo care is one of the great success stories in neonatology, and it came out of necessity. Bogota, Colombia, 1978. Edgar Ray Sanabria was dealing with a crisis. Too many preterm infants, not enough incubators, high infection rates in the NICU. He developed a protocol where mothers and later fathers held preterm babies skin-to-skin on their chests for extended periods, basically serving as a living incubator.
The results were not subtle.
Not at all. In the original trial, kangaroo care reduced infant mortality in preterm babies by 40%. That's the kind of effect size you almost never see in medical research. Modern data from Stanford's NICU, this is 2025 data, shows that 3 hours daily of skin-to-skin contact reduced length of stay by an average of 5.2 days, with cost savings of about $12,000 per infant.
$12,000 per infant? If this were a pharmaceutical, it would be front page news and the patent would be worth billions.
It's not a pharmaceutical. It's a behavior that doesn't require any equipment, any prescription, any specialized training. Which, paradoxically, is probably why it gets less attention than it deserves. There's no marketing budget for skin-to-skin contact.
This is not just for mothers. The data on fathers is really interesting.
A 2023 randomized controlled trial in infant behavior and development compared paternal skin-to-skin to maternal skin-to-skin for reducing infant crying and found no significant difference. Fathers show similar oxytocin responses to infant contact. The idea that skin-to-skin is only for mothers is the third big misconception worth busting. Non-birthing parents, adoptive parents, grandparents, anyone who provides that slow, gentle, sustained contact is activating the same neurobiological pathways.
Which matters enormously for families where the birthing parent is recovering from a C-section or dealing with postpartum depression or just needs to sleep for more than 90 consecutive minutes.
This connects to something I want to underline, the structural brain changes that happen in new parents. There was a landmark longitudinal MRI study in Nature Neuroscience, published in 2025, that tracked brain changes across the first 6 months postpartum. They found increased gray matter density in the hypothalamus, the striatum, and the prefrontal cortex. These are regions involved in motivation, reward processing, and executive function, all critical for responsive caregiving.
Those changes weren't uniform.
The brain changes were blunted in parents who reported low levels of affectionate touch with their infant. And here's the kicker. The relationship is almost certainly bidirectional. Touch drives brain changes, and brain changes enable more attuned touch. So if you're a parent who's struggling with touch, whether from sensory overload, postpartum depression, or anything else, there's a risk of a negative spiral. Less touch leads to fewer neuroadaptive changes, which makes touch feel less rewarding, which leads to less touch.
Which makes the touched-out problem not just a comfort issue, but potentially a neurodevelopmental one, for both parent and baby.
And that's why getting the public health messaging right is so important. The current message is basically cuddle your baby as much as possible. Skin to skin is best, attachment depends on it. Which is factually true in the aggregate, but practically harmful for the substantial minority of parents who can't do it without significant distress.
What does the data say about alternatives? If a parent is touched out, what actually works?
This is where a really interesting 2026 pilot study from UC San Francisco comes in. The researchers tested what they called structured cuddle breaks, 20 minutes of intentional skin-to-skin contact at that optimal slow stroke speed, followed by 40 minutes of non-contact soothing. The non-contact options included rocking in a bassinet, white noise, singing, things that regulate the baby without requiring physical contact with the parent.
The 20-40 rule.
And the results were striking. Parent-reported tactile aversion dropped by 28% over the study period. Meanwhile, infant cortisol reduction was equivalent to what you'd get from continuous contact. The babies weren't losing out. They were getting high-quality, intentional touch when it happened, and they were still being soothed during the non-contact periods.
The trade-off isn't parent comfort versus infant well-being. You can preserve both.
That's the crucial insight. Cuddling is not a binary, good or bad, doing it or failing. It's a dose-response relationship with individual variability. Some infants need more touch, some need less. Some parents can provide more touch, some need more recovery time. The goal is to find the sweet spot where the infant gets the regulation benefits and the parent isn't burning out their sensory system.
Partners and support networks have a huge role here that I think gets underemphasized.
The single most effective thing a partner can do for a touched-out parent is take over the non-cuddling care tasks. Diaper changes, burping, rocking, bottle feeding if applicable. Every non-contact care task the partner handles preserves the primary parent's touch bandwidth for high-quality, intentional cuddling rather than constant low-grade handling.
Because constant low-grade handling is exactly what burns out the C-tactile system. It's not the 20 minutes of slow stroking that causes the problem. It's the 8 hours of the baby just being on you, pulling your hair, digging an elbow into your collarbone.
The C-tactile afferents are tuned for specific input. Fast, irregular, pokey, grabby touch doesn't activate them. It activates different pathways, including stress pathways. So the parent is getting all the tactile load with none of the neurochemical buffering. It's the worst of both worlds.
I'm thinking about the partner who wants to help, but doesn't know how. They see their spouse drowning in touch, and they offer to give her a break by holding the baby. But if the baby just wants to be held, they're not actually solving the problem. They're just shifting the touch burden to themselves, which is better than nothing. But it's not addressing the root issue.
That's a really important distinction. The break that a touched-out parent needs is not necessarily a break from the baby. It's a break from being the sensory regulator. And that means the baby still needs regulation, but it can come from someone else's nervous system or from non-contact methods. The partner who says, "I'll take the baby for a walk in the carrier," is providing a genuine break. The partner who says, "I'll hold the baby while you shower," is also providing a genuine break, but it's short. The parent comes back from the shower and the baby is right back on them. The deeper solution is building non-contact soothing into the routine so the primary parent isn't the only regulation tool in the house.
There's something else I want to dig into, which is the context dependence of oxytocin. You mentioned the 2024 study where oxytocin increased startle in high cortisol people. What's the practical implication? If I'm a stressed out parent, should I not cuddle?
The implication is more nuanced. It's not, don't cuddle if you're stressed. It's check your state before you initiate contact, and if you're in a highly activated stress state, take a brief reset first. Even 30 seconds of slow breathing, specifically extending the exhale, can shift the autonomic balance enough to change the valence of the subsequent interaction.
Because the exhale is parasympathetic.
Long exhales activate the vagus nerve, so you're essentially priming your own nervous system to receive the oxytocin that touch will release in a way that's calming rather than amplifying. This isn't woo-woo, it's basic autonomic physiology. If your sympathetic nervous system is fully engaged, oxytocin can actually enhance the stress response rather than dampen it. A 30-second breathing reset changes the context in which the oxytocin lands.
The advice isn't cuddle more. It's cuddle better, and know when you need a minute first.
Cuddle better has a very specific operational meaning. Remember the 3 centimeters per second peak response for C-tactile afferents? That's the speed to aim for. It's slow enough that it forces you to be present. You can't do a 3 centimeter per second stroke while scrolling your phone or mentally running through your to-do list. The speed itself demands attention.
Which probably contributes to why it's regulating for the parent too. The act of providing slow, intentional touch is itself a mindfulness practice, whether you call it that or not.
There's data on this. The 2025 analysis in pediatrics that showed the 43% reduction in infant crying, it also found that the parents providing the touch had an 18% improvement in their own sleep efficiency. And I don't think that's just because the baby was crying less. I think the act of providing slow, regulated touch helps down-regulate the parent's own nervous system.
We've talked about the neurochemistry, the C-tactile system, the touched-out phenomenon, the 20-40 rule. Let's pull it together into something someone can actually use at 3 in the morning.
Let's get practical. First, for parents feeling touched out, the 20-40 rule. 20 minutes of intentional skin-to-skin stroking at that slow pace, about 3 to 5 centimeters per second, which is roughly the speed you'd use to trace a lazy spiral on someone's back, followed by 40 minutes of non-contact soothing. The baby gets the full cortisol reduction benefit, and your sensory system gets recovery time.
The non-contact soothing. What's actually effective?
Rhythmic motion is the most evidence, supported. Rocking, either in arms or in a bassinet, at roughly 1 to 2 cycles per second. White noise at about 60 to 65 decibels, louder than you might think because the intrauterine environment is surprisingly loud. And singing. The pitch contours of lullabies seem to be cross-culturally consistent in ways that suggest they're tuned to infant auditory processing.
Second practical point for partners and support people. Take the non-cuddle tasks. Change the diapers. Do the burping. Handle the rocking when the baby just needs motion, not skin contact. Every task you absorb preserves the primary parent's touch capacity for the contact that actually requires it.
Third, check your own state. If you're feeling angry, resentful, or overwhelmed, a 30-second breathing reset. Slow inhale, longer exhale, can change how your nervous system responds to the touch you're about to give. Oxytocin is context sensitive. Don't cuddle from a place of obligation or guilt. Cuddle from a place of regulation, or take a minute to get there first.
The through line here is that cuddling is not a moral obligation. It's a neurobiological tool, And like any tool, it works best when you use it intentionally rather than constantly.
That's the cultural shift I think we need. The breast is best, and attachment parenting movements have done important work in emphasizing the biological importance of close contact. But they've also created a pressure cooker where any deviation from maximal physical availability is framed as a failure. The neuroscience doesn't support that framing. It supports a model of attuned, intentional contact with room for the parent's nervous system to recover.
Which raises the open question. If cuddling is so biologically fundamental, why does our culture make it so complicated? We've built this elaborate apparatus of guilt and expectation around a behavior that should be among the simplest things we do.
I think part of it is that we've medicalized and moralized parenting to an extraordinary degree. Everything a parent does is now subject to optimization. There's a right way and a wrong way, and the stakes are framed as permanent. If you don't do skin-to-skin in the first hour, you'll damage the attachment bond forever. It's catastrophizing that sells books and gets clicks, but doesn't reflect the actual neuroscience of attachment, which shows that bonding is a cumulative process with enormous plasticity.
The wearable technology that's coming is going to add another layer to this. I've seen projections that the first FDA cleared infant stress monitor could arrive by late 2027. Something that tracks heart rate variability and electrodermal activity in real time.
Which could be useful, or it could be another vector for anxiety. Imagine looking at a screen and seeing a number that says your baby's stress level is elevated, and you interpret that as, I'm failing at soothing. When the reality might be that the baby is just having a moment, or the sensor is misreading, or the elevated stress is developmentally appropriate. Real-time biometric feedback is powerful, but it requires real-time interpretive skill that most parents haven't been taught.
The quantified baby. Build me a nursery, I can't stop optimizing.
And the optimization mindset is exactly what makes the touched-out problem worse. If you're tracking every minute of skin-to-skin and comparing yourself to some idealized target, you're adding cognitive load to a system that's already overloaded. The data should serve the parent, not the other way around.
I think the single most useful thing we've said today is that needing to put the baby down is not a failure. It's your nervous system asking for the recovery time it needs to provide quality touch later. And the data supports this. The 2040 protocol shows you can get equivalent infant outcomes while protecting parent well-being.
The other thing I hope lands is that the cuddle hormone is not a magic bullet. Oxytocin is a neuromodulator, not a love potion. Its effects depend entirely on the context of your own stress state. If you're forcing yourself to cuddle through resentment and exhaustion, the neurochemistry might actually be working against you. Giving yourself permission to reset first isn't selfish. It's physiologically sound.
The bottom line is, cuddle intentionally, not constantly. Use the slow stroke. Take the 40-minute breaks. Let your partner handle the diapers. And if you're feeling guilty about not wanting to be touched, understand that your nervous system is doing exactly what evolution designed it to do under load.
If you found this useful, share it with a new parent who needs permission to put the baby down. That's the review pitch. We're not asking for ratings. We're asking you to send this to someone who's been told that good parents never need a break.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In 1902, a Russian naturalist on the Kamchatka Peninsula reported discovering a species of mantis shrimp that had been presumed extinct since the Eocene, only for the specimen to be eaten by a seagull before it could be formally catalogued. The naturalist, one Vladimir Kropotkin, apparently watched the entire event from approximately 40 meters away and was unable to intervene. His field notes from that day consist of a single sentence, "The gull has no regard for posterity."
Right. So the only known specimen of a species that survived 60 million years gets eaten by a seagull in front of the one person on Earth who could identify it.
That's a level of scientific tragedy I was not prepared for. I'm going to be thinking about Kropotkin for the rest of the day, just standing there on a cliff, watching a gull undo 60 million years of evolutionary history in one gulp.
The gull has no regard for posterity. That's going to be my new email signature.
This has been My Weird Prompts. I'm Herman Poppleberry.
I'm Korn. Find us at myweirdprompts.com or on Spotify and wherever you listen. We'll be back next week.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks. Thanks for listening to our show. My weird promise, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore. A thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.